What is the threshold for number of positive cases needed to postpone a game?
And this may be for some of you an unsatisfying answer. We're going to have to be in a position to understand and address situations as they occur. Having a series of just hard and fast rules in this environment, I'm pretty sure, is not going to be the best approach.
That's National Hockey League Commissioner Gary Bettman, who does actually have a lot of plans in place as teams take to the ice tonight. Like other sports, the NHL has systems for COVID testing and contact tracing, but with seven teams in Canada, it's also got a geography issue that's going to make this season uniquely fascinating, all the way to the Stanley Cup. I'm Pablo Torre. It's Wednesday, January 13th. This is ESPN Daily. Greg, I'm so happy to have you here to discuss the return of your beloved sport, not least because I know, admittedly, very little about the NHL in general.
I'm happy to be here too, because there are times in the last year I wasn't sure there was going to be a hockey season.
Greg Wyshynski has been explaining hockey to everyone who will listen for more than a decade, and he's co-hosted the podcast ESPN on Ice.
They aren't doing the bubbles like they did last summer. They're forging ahead in their own arenas. There was a whole kind of labor component, too, that made things a little bit hinky and edgy for a while, but the NHL forges on. We're going to have hockey this year. The Stanley Cup will be awarded.
So we're talking, Greg, right after this press conference with the commissioner of the NHL, Gary Bettman, about all of this stuff.
We're very focused on what needs to be done. We've issued 12 protocols spanning 213 pages. The protocols are not.
What was the vibe if you had to sort of read the Zoom room?
I would say the vibe is cautious optimism.
I'm not going to prognosticate as to what we'll do in every situation, because when a situation arises, we're going to have to gather all the resources and information we can and make the best judgment we can.
You know, the NHL has seen what's happened in all of these other sports that have reopened, in particular the NBA, which is obviously having to shuffle around things. They approach their season knowing that there is going to have to be postponements, knowing that there's going to have to be adjustments. It's going to be a shortened season, 56 games, and it's going to look very, very different than typical National Hockey League seasons insofar as the structure of the conferences and the fact that we're not even going to have conferences actually this year. They're going to have to be able to change on the fly, to use a hockey terminology. And I think they're prepared to do it, get it done, and then play a full 82-game 2021-22 season next fall.
So the NHL during the shortened season last year went to this Canada-based bubble, and that seemed to work really well. I believe there were zero positive cases. Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct. The NHL was extraordinarily happy with the way things went in the bubble. Problem being that everybody involved knew it was a one-time only deal, a necessity. They couldn't go back to the players and ask them, hey, do you mind being away from your families and friends, not for two and a half months at maximum, but for the entirety of the regular season and then the postseason? It was a non-starter. So they had some other options on the table. They had a hybrid bubble idea where teams would kind of create hub cities in Canada and the U.S., have the ability to come and go from the bubble. But what they settled on was more like what the NBA decided to do, which is to have teams open up in their own home arenas, mostly without fans, and kind of hope for the best.
Since they announced this plan in December, Greg, it hasn't been the best so far. The San Jose Sharks don't yet have approval from their local government to play at home. The Dallas Stars are dealing with COVID issues and had to do some rescheduling already. But the season is starting tonight. So talk us through the league's pandemic plans.
Obviously, you know, just like every sport, they have their testing protocols and their socially distancing protocols. But in the structure of the season, they've tried to create a way for these teams to limit risk. And by that, they realigned the National Hockey League into four different divisions. including one that is an all-Canadian team division due to the issues at the border between the U.S. and Canada. So they've grouped together these teams as best they can geographically. They are only going to play each other. And they've also adopted a baseball style and or minor league hockey style schedule wherein a team will come in, play two consecutive road games against the home team, and then leave and have another two-game series after that and so on and so forth. And the thought is that it's going to reduce travel, which is going to reduce risk, and then incidentally also reduce cost a little bit in a season in which they're going to lose over $1 billion.
So on the money front, the first thing I noticed about the NHL's divisional realignment plan for this season is the fact that there is sponsorship of the very names of the divisions. And I recognize, Greg, that I'm a podcast host who does ad reads. Not a lot of high ground here for me at ESPN. But what did you make of that aspect of it? Explain what's happening there.
So the National Hockey League and hockey fans in particular, outside of Major League Baseball, they might be the fan base with the most traditionalist tendencies, especially when it comes to advertising. You talk to any hockey fan about putting an ad on a hockey jersey, and you are going to see flames develop in the irises of their eyes as they start talking about the sanctity of the sweater. So to put ads on the helmets this year for the first time was a huge step forward for the National Hockey League. But as we're going to see this season, there's going to be a lot more advertising around these games than we've ever seen before. For example, there's going to be ads all over the rink in different places, ads on the helmets. They didn't go ads on jerseys. That's still beyond the pale. Gary Bettman said this week that that wasn't something he wanted to broach as part of a, you know, extreme revenue generating plan during COVID, but rather a decision they would want to make in a different time. But the important thing to know about these ads on the helmets is that a lot of them happen to also be the companies that sponsor the names on the front of arenas. And in a lot of these cases, it's not so much opening up a new vein for additional revenue. It's satisfying the contracts and satisfying the obligations that these teams have to their current sponsors. So maybe you don't get 41 home dates with fans in the building to see the big name on the front of the arena. But to help make it up to you, we're going to put your name on the helmet during these games.
So I want to dig into just the mechanics of these new divisions, like what that means for the matchups we're going to see and not see during this regular season. So dissect for me what this all is going to look like as a competitive scheduling concern.
Well, as you said, we have division sponsored this year. So you have the Scotia NHL North Division, the Honda NHL West Division, the Discover NHL Central Division, and the Mass Mutual NHL East Division. Now, what they've done is they remixed these teams because they had to stick these seven Canadian teams together due to the border issue. And they tried to do it geographically. There were a couple of interesting wrinkles here. St. Louis, for example, would naturally be in a central division. That's where Chicago and Columbus and Detroit are. But they asked to be in the West Division, one, for competitive reasons, and two, because they liked the idea of their games starting a little bit later than having to play a lot of Eastern time zone games being a Central time zone team. So you have them in the West, and you have Dallas in the Central, where the Florida teams are. It's all very confusing, but it's NHL geography. It's going to be the top four teams from each division make the playoffs. One plays four, and then two plays three. And then you advance the four division winners to the championship round.
What is the postseason going to feel like given those changes? What's it going to look like this year, unlike all the rest?
Well, there's a couple of different aspects of it. First of all, the NHL only knows how to really sell one thing well, and it's rivalries. And so you are going to get a very healthy dose of rivalry games within these divisions. Not only the traditional ones like a Rangers and Philly kind of situation or, you know, Pittsburgh and Washington, but you're also going to see the animosity grow between teams because they're going to be playing each other upwards of, you know, seven or eight times a season in this season. So by the time we get to the playoffs, the hope is that everybody hates each other. What this does is gives hockey fans for one season only, we think, the chance for dream matchups for the Stanley Cup. So you take a team like Toronto out of the NHL North Division and a team like Boston out of the NHL East Division. Well, these two teams are usually in the same division. they could never play for the Stanley Cup. This season, they could potentially play for the Cup, and that would be something that every fan would want to watch because these two teams hate each other.
There's a phrase that I keep thinking about when it comes to how all of these sports are approaching these COVID seasons in ways that have never been done before. And that phrase is never let a good tragedy go to waste. And I wonder, Greg, is there innovation here that may last past this season? Or is this all feeling incredibly temporary? Hey, let's just get through this 1 year and then we'll sort of reset it all back to how you guys were familiar with it before.
There are going to be some innovations, I think, particularly in the fan experience that are going to carry over to subsequent seasons. From a structural standpoint, I think the National Hockey League reverts back to the format that we've seen in previous seasons. Now, that said, I recently spoke with the Florida Panthers, who are a team that is going to open up with fans at the beginning of the season. And they reinvented the fan experience based on what they needed to do to make the arena safe for COVID. So mobile ordering from your seat was not something that you could do at Florida Panthers games until right now. That's going to be something that they do in perpetuity. My favorite tidbit from that conversation is they had to reinvent the urinal.
Wait. This is enormous news. I'd never heard anything about urinal reinvention.
Well, it's not so much the urinal itself, Pablo. It's the fact that when you're standing there in the arena and you're all in a big line against the wall, you know, there's a certain amount of closeness, let's say, between you and the guy next to you.
Yes, very unsocially distant.
Indeed it is. So what the Florida Panthers decided because of this pandemic is it was high time to raise the walls in between the urinals and their arena to from the floor to the ceiling.
Wow.
These are the types of little incremental changes that we'll see carried over. But the NHL writ large, I think, will look very much like it did in 2019-20, plus the Seattle Kraken coming in when we get to the following season.
After the break, I want to talk about all of these teams that are allegedly going to hate each other.
Now let's talk about the play of the week. The pressure to follow up Hypnotic and Cognac weighing heavy on the team. Hypnotic was in the cup, blue, and ready for the play. And boom, Añejo Tequila came in with the smooth assist to Hypnotic's tropical fruit finish. Shaken, strained, poured, it was green and good. The playmaking splash shifted the tempo, another great cocktail from the Hypnotic team. Every season is Hypnotic and Tequila season. Hypnotic Liqueur, Bardstown, Kentucky, 17% alcohol by volume. Hypnotic reminds you to think wisely. Drink wisely.
I want to get into these locker rooms and onto the ice with last year's Stanley Cup winners in the Tampa Bay Lightning. Remind us how they won, remind us who they beat, and tell me if they have a shot at being this good again.
Oh, I think they definitely have a shot at being this good again. It's a question of how they'll get there. They return most of that team. The regular season is going to be interesting, though, because the salary cap was flat at $81.5 million, the Lightning had to kind of try to make do with some financial movements under the salary cap. And one of the things that happened was their star player, considered to be the best winger in hockey, Nikita Kucherov, had hip surgery. He will be out of the lineup for the entirety of the regular season. Not good news on the ice, great news off the ice because his salary comes off the cap because he's going to be on long-term injured reserve. He should be healthy for the postseason. They should be a cup contender again. The team they beat, though, the Dallas Stars, I'm not convinced about. They're going to be without two of their better players for at least the first couple months of the season. Tyler Seguin, their star center. Ben Bishop, one of their two starting goaltenders. I think there might be a little regression happening with Dallas this season, so I'm not quite convinced they're going to be invited back to the postseason party.
So the team that Vegas really likes is the Colorado Avalanche, and I think they have the best odds to win as we're talking right now. Tell me why they may be worth putting your hypothetical, obviously non-gambling, entertainment purposes only money behind.
They're one of the deepest, most talented teams in the league, and they're a team that showed so much promise last season that they became the great what if of the playoffs. They were decimated by injuries when they were eliminated from the playoffs. There's a notion of, had they been healthy, how far could they have gone? And once you're that bridesmaid in the playoffs like that, then people just jump on you as a potential cup champion the following season.
When I close my eyes, Greg, and if you were to ask me to sort of imagine an NHL team, I'm probably imagining the Toronto Maple Leafs logo. What is going on with the Maple Leafs this year?
The Maple Leafs are a fascinating team. And they're fascinating, one, because they haven't won the Stanley Cup since 1967. And they haven't won in the first round of the playoffs in almost two decades. So there's a certain amount of lovable loserness to them that would exist were they not the most hated team in hockey. The problem with the Leafs is that they conduct themselves like they're the Yankees, but in actuality, they're like a century of the Cubs. And so they're an interesting case study because they're almost like a stalking horse for the rest of the league, and especially in Canada. That's what's going to make that Canadian division so interesting, is all of those teams outside of Montreal, who actually are the New York Yankees of hockey, all want to take a chip off the Toronto Maple Leafs. They all hate them. They all hate the fact that no matter what the Leafs do, they make news in Canada. So if you're someone like the Winnipeg Jets, you're like, I want to dedicate my life to beating Toronto every single opportunity I get in this division. But they do have a lot of compelling aspects to them that make me think it could be the year, maybe. They have one of the best players in the world in Austin Matthews. He's a player born in Arizona. He could be a player that leads the league in goals this season for the first time. He's got a running mate named Mitch Marner, who plays on his wing, dynamic young player. John Tavares, who people might remember from the New York Islanders, left the Islanders high and dry to go to his childhood team in Toronto. That was a big controversy. They're a deep team. They're a talented team. They're also a defensively flawed team. But they are, without question, one of the marquee teams in this league, whether you love them or hate them.
I want to turn now to a team with a far shorter history, and that is the Las Vegas Golden Knights. And look, I know they launched as this expansion team just three seasons ago. They made the Stanley Cup Finals that very first year. And I also know a little bit about this insane locker room soap opera they have going on, which is endlessly fascinating to me. So explain to us what's happening in Vegas.
It is one of the best soap operas in sports right now, to be quite candid. They came into the league a few years ago, like you said. They were the Golden Misfits. They were players that were cast off from teams around the league into the expansion draft. They all came together and made the Stanley Cup final in their inaugural season, a first-year team making the Cup final. The next year, their season ended in postseason controversy, losing to the San Jose Sharks in seven games in the first round. And then things got real weird. The beloved inaugural coach, Gerard Gallant, fired by the team. And then they hired Pete DeBoer, the head coach of those very arch-rival San Jose Sharks, who eliminated the Golden Knights in the playoffs. A reviled man amongst the fan base who then became their head coach. Then things got even better. Marc-Andre Fleury, the former Pittsburgh Penguins goalie who was the face of the Golden Knights franchise during their first few seasons, he was basically replaced at the trade deadline when they acquired a goalie by the name of Robin Lehner. This led to some pretty ill will amongst the fans and within the team, to the point where in the postseason, Fleury's agent published a Photoshop image of his client being stabbed in the back by a broadsword bearing the name of head coach Pete DeBoer. So right now you're at apex of soap opera, but then there's even more.
Wait, hold on. Before we move on from the Photoshop, Greg, we got to stop and appreciate this because I'm looking at it right now. This is literally a very long medieval sword that is covered in blood, thrust through the number 29 jersey in question with the name DeBoer inscribed on it, which is honestly like a really good Photoshop, if nothing else.
Oh, it belongs in the Louvre, but it also is very on brand because they are, after all, the Golden Knights. And, you know, you don't get stabbed in the back by a knife. You get stabbed in the back by a broadsword. The soap opera got even better, though, during this offseason. So the Golden Knights wanted to make a big free agent splash. The guy they targeted was Alex Pietrangelo, who's the captain and defensive star for the St. Louis Blues. He decided he wanted to move on. He couldn't get the contract that he wanted. So they wanted to bring him in. To do that, they had to get further under the salary cap. So they traded away two franchise favorites. Center Paul Stastny was traded to Winnipeg. And then defenseman Nate Schmidt, who was basically the ambassador of fun in the playoff bubble last year, organizing field trips and barbecues and stuff. One of the most beloved players in the franchise. He gets traded to Vancouver, so they have room for Pietrangelo on their roster. All of this is a win-at-all-costs kind of attitude instilled by Bill Foley, the businessman who owns the team, who from the moment he bought the Golden Knights envisioned them as a Stanley Cup winner immediately. But, dude, it's like... it's like the Golden Misfits got a haircut, put on a tie, and got a job at the bank. They're not the team of fun anymore. They're the corporate business team. When you do start swapping out these parts and bringing in these ringers, does it add up to it being more of a championship attitude, or does it add up to there being some derision from the quote-unquote Golden Misfits that were there since the beginning to see these other guys start showing up?
I want to ask you a provincial sort of concern here, Greg, because I live in New York City. I remember very clearly my mom waking me up for Game 7 of the 1994 Stanley Cup Finals to alert me that the Rangers were doing it. They're doing it. And my parents know nothing about hockey, and I know only a little bit more than them as of now, as I stand before you today in 2021. However, I know that there is a really promising young player in the Rangers organization. I know there's promise around this team. How much of that is real? And tell me how optimistic I should be.
Well, first of all, as a New Jersey Devils fan, my therapist said that that never happened, the Rangers winning in 94. So I'm not quite sure what you're referring to. No, the Rangers are a really promising team. And what an interesting story they are. How many teams in New York can say that they announced to their fans that we are rebuilding through a letter published by the team and said, look, we're going to be in for some pain as an organization? And then, like, 2 years later, they're ready to contend again. That's the Rangers. Mm. The Rangers made all the right moves in tearing down their roster, in drafting well, in lucking out by enticing Artemi Panarin, the top free agent 2 summers ago, to sign with New York on a 7-year deal. He was, I thought, an MVP caliber player last season for them. And then they luck out completely, once again, to the detriment of my Devils, by getting the first overall pick in the NHL draft lottery. They drafted a kid by the name of Alexis Lafreniere, a left wing who's expected to be a next level elite goal scorer in this league. They're a great, great collection of young players. I think outside of the LA Kings, the Rangers have the best pipeline of talent right now. I don't know if they're going to actualize as a playoff team this year because of the format of the season, but the future is blindingly bright for this team on Broadway.
Greg, something that I do love about the NHL is that they sometimes play these games outdoors, which are visually amazing. Is any of that on tap for this year?
Well, COVID claimed the Winter Classic, which was scheduled to be played in Minnesota this year. It also claimed the outdoor game that the Carolina Hurricanes were going to play at NC State. But the NHL started investigating some outdoor spots. They turned their attention to Lake Tahoe, where there are going to be 2 regular season outdoor games played, one between the Colorado Avalanche and Vegas Golden Knights on February 20th, and one between the Philadelphia Flyers and the Boston Bruins on February 21st. They're going to be played without spectators. They're going to be played with a beautiful Lake Tahoe vista behind them. And I'm a big fan of this. I'm a big fan of the NHL using this opportunity to put outdoor hockey in weird places.
Yes.
My dream forever has been either a game on the National Mall in DC or a game in Central Park in New York City. Problem being, though, is if you're playing without spectators, good luck keeping, you know, Rangers fans and Capitals fans away from those games. Better to play it in Lake Tahoe, I think.
So, Greg, before we let you go, I do want to jump in the time machine with you. Let's pretend we've gotten to the end of the NHL playoffs. What is the sport looking like? Who is in the Stanley Cup Finals?
Well, I'll take the Lightning. I mean, there's no reason not to. They are, I think, top to bottom, the best team in hockey. But, Pablo, this is a weird season. strange things are afoot all over sports. My goodness, look at the Buffalo Bills and the Cleveland Browns.
Yes.
So in a season and in a year where weird things are happening in sports, wouldn't it then tell you that this, a season in which the Toronto Maple Leafs don't have to worry about playing their tormentors, the Boston Bruins, because they're all the way in the East, that they would advance through the North Division of Canadian teams, that they would get through the championship semifinals, that they would play for the Stanley Cup against the Tampa Bay Lightning, and finally break through to win the Cup for the first time since 1967? Wouldn't this be the year for that to happen?
Greg Wyshynski, I am closing my eyes. And I can see it now, honestly. I see it now. I see so many people getting furious at both of us on ESPN Daily.
All I want to see is a mustached Austin Matthews lifting the Stanley Cup, giving Canada their first cup championship since 1993, and knowing that it was a kid from Arizona that brought so much joy to Canada. That's all I want.
All right, coming up. The one and only time I've heard Nick Saban lower his defenses and open up.
Vivid Seats wants to get you to the games you love this spring. Experience every pitch, assist, and game-winning shot live and in person. And the best part? Each transaction is a step toward a free 11th ticket with Vivid Seats rewards. Score unbeatable perks like free tickets, surprise seat upgrades, and annual birthday deals. As the official ticketing partner of ESPN, Vivid Seats is offering you $20 off your first $200 ticket purchase with code DAILY. That's code DAILY. Visit VividSeats.com or download the app today. Vivid Seats. Experience it live.
Here's another story I want you to know. Nick Saban can be a nightmare interview. He is harsh and tight-lipped and extremely, extremely serious. A lot like his good friend Bill Belichick, actually, which I discovered firsthand on live television a few years ago while trying to get Saban to loosen up on the subject of that very friendship.
You don't guys have like inside jokes you laugh about?
We do.
You're just not going to tell us.
No.
But our friends at E60 would have significantly more luck getting Saban to soften, probably because they just asked him to share a story, any story he wanted. And the best college football coach of all time took them back in time, long before his record 7 national titles, all the way back to West Virginia, to meet a version of Nick Saban I'd never heard before.
Tell me a story, take one.
I'm Nick Saban, and I want to tell you a story. I'm going to go way back to when I was in high school. The school was the center of the community, and I was a 15-year-old kid, sophomore quarterback. We're playing at Masontown Valley, and this place is up in the boondocks, and you got to walk through the graveyard to get to the field, and everybody in Monongo is in town. We're like 8-1, and we've got to win this game to have a chance to get in the state tournament. And we get behind 18-0. We come back in the second half and get it to 18-12. We get the ball back with a minute 25 to go in the game. I'm calling the plays because I called all the plays as a 15-year-old sophomore. 4th and 12, ball's on a 20-yard line, 12 seconds to go in the game. Coach Keener calls the last timeout. So I run over to him, and he says, he called me Young Nicky. He says, what do you think, Young Nicky? And I says, I think you should call this play. Because I didn't want to be responsible at 15 years old for what worked or what didn't work. He said, you have the fastest guy in the state playing left halfback. You got a 3-time All-State guy playing split end. Make sure one of those two guys get the ball. And I really don't care what play you call. And this is my first coaching lesson I ever learned. When you get in critical situations in the game, don't think of plays, think of players. So on 4th and 12 to win the game, I called 26 crossbar pass, which faked to the left halfback, throw a post corner to the split end, and scored a touchdown, won the game 19-18, and that was my first coaching lesson. You like the story? It's true.
I'm Pablo Torre. This has been ESPN Daily. I'll talk to you tomorrow.